This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Algeria hostage crisis over after further casualties, spies, Chopin, and a last-minute rescue in Libya. And our audiobook review is a crime special looking at Raymond Chandler's greatest stories and a new audiobook from Stuart Neville, Ratlines. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
So the next Conservative manifesto in 2015 will ask for a mandate from the British people for a Conservative government to negotiate a new settlement with our European partners in the next Parliament. It will be a relationship with the single market at its heart. And when we have negotiated that new settlement, we will give the British people a referendum with a very simple in or out choice: to stay in the European Union on these new terms or to come out altogether. It will be an in-out referendum.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. David Cameron has made his long-awaited speech on Europe and has dropped his bombshell. A future Conservative government will offer Britons their first chance to vote on European membership since they said yes back in 1975. Ed Miliband, meanwhile, says, or sounds like he's saying, that a Labour government would not put the question to the public.
My position is no, we don't want an in-out referendum.
Joining me to discuss all of this, I have the New Statesman's political editor, Raphael Baer, and alongside him, the political journalist and author, Andrew Jimson, and down the line, our columnist, Simon Jenkins. A warm welcome to you all. Now, call it bold, call it brave, or call it downright stupid, David Cameron has committed himself to a referendum on European Union membership in the next Parliament. His much-trailed speech, brought forward and then postponed, spelt out his personal desire to stay in, but only if he can extract better conditions for the UK. Now, Andrew, first of all, referendums and Europe, we've had a lot of talk about them over the years, in relatively recent times, from Tony Blair and from the Liberal Democrats saying they'd have an in-out referendum. Is this one different? Would this one really have to happen?
Well, I think it's an act of weakness. It was weakness when Harold Wilson, who didn't want to have a referendum, when first suggested by Tony Benn at the beginning of the 1970s, he eventually realised that it was the only way of holding the Labour Party together, and Cameron has reached the same conclusion. He's played his cards so skillfully that he's made himself look quite strong, but I think actually he's in a very weak position, and this referendum could end up doing the Tory party enormous damage.
And do you think it has to happen, right, Raph?
I think it'll now be very difficult to avoid for the simple reason that, well, first of all, you go back over history, the trajectory has always been for resisting referendums, insisting they will happen, then finding ways of ducking out of them. and ultimately, that has created this environment in which there's sort of so much momentum behind this idea of consulting the people. It's going to be very difficult for Labour and Liberal Democrats to go through an election campaign being posed the question, sort of, they trust the people, why don't you? So for that reason, I wouldn't be at all surprised if everyone ends up with some kind of referendum in their manifesto.
And on the principle of the thing, I mean, looking at the newspapers this morning, Guardian, Independent are saying this is a terrible thing. Times, Mail and Telegraph are saying it's an excellent thing. Quite a clean left-right divide. But is there any principled democratic reason that you can think of for saying no to giving the people a choice on this?
I think there is a very strong reason, a strong argument for saying, if for people who want Britain to be a member of the European Union, you do need to renew consent. I don't think it's very hard to deny that the institution that we're a member of now is very different from the one that we joined in the 1970s. So from that point of view, ultimately, yes, I think there's a very strong case for saying you need to consult people. I think the what's been under-recognised is that Ed Miliband and indeed Nick Clegg have a escape hatch on this one, which is that they have both accepted broadly the Sovereignty Act, the European Union Sovereignty Act, which provides for a referendum in the event of any big treaty or transfer of powers to Brussels. So from a sort of technical, tactical point of view over the next couple of years, if Ed Miliband is really feeling the heat on this, which I think he will, he can say, look, there's going to be big changes. The nature of Britain's relationship with the European Union is going to be different. That will be expressed in the treaty. And we don't deny that that will require a referendum. So the Labour Party just sort of has to hold its nerve for a few months or a bit longer to wait until those divisions in the Conservative Party that Andrew talked about that flushed out, and his position isn't as weak as it looks, but it's very vulnerable.
So that's Ed Miliband, but David Cameron, Simon, is this a move of strength or of weakness on his part, do you think?
I just always think it's a bit odd to accuse politicians like that. I mean, politicians are never where they want to be. They're always in a predicament inherited from their forebears, and they have to cope with reality as it is. I don't think Cameron had many options. I mean, you can say when you haven't got options, you're strong or you're weak. The case, as people just said, I mean, the case for a referendum in circumstances like those now facing Europe, period, is obviously very strong. I mean, the most acts of parliament, most legislatures, most of Europe do recognise that these are major issues that are appropriate for the concept of the referendum. And I don't think, given the amount of, sort of turmoil this generates, it's a bad thing, as I think Raphael said, to give the British people another go at this. You know, we do it with secession. Secession is a constitutional matter. Separatism, we do it with Europe. Where the thing gets totally bedeviled is of course politicians never like running the risk of a referendum. Holding a referendum appears therefore like a weakness. I don't think it should be seen that way. I think it should be seen as a perfectly normal way of coping with this degree of change. But the speech was far more significant in other respects, I think. I think he was absolutely and clearly laying down that so far and no further is all he's prepared to do. I don't think it's reasonable to say you've got to tell us what you're going to come back with to say whether that's a success or failure. But he was clearly saying no closer union, no more political union. We want to get back to the state of affairs where this was regarded as essentially a trade relationship with the amount of disciplines, joint disciplines that are required for free trade. But we do not want a federal Europe. And he was saying that. I think to that extent he was being brave, but I think he's also being realistic. I mean, that's the point of view of certainly his party, or most of his party, and I would have thought of most of the British people.
And do you think, Simon, it sounded to me when he was saying, well, what we want really is a common market, I think at one point, sort of 1970s phrase. Do you think he was saying that signing the Treaty of Maastricht had been a mistake?
Well, every one of these treaties is a child of its times. Maastricht, I mean, John Major did get real concessions at Maastricht. I mean, he got the, you know, the big four opt-outs, which other countries have also got. So we're not on our own in this respect. But Maastricht was, well, the key thing at Maastricht was the move towards a single currency union. And the single currency union is political union. It's silly to pretend otherwise. And that decision is already taken. There's no great sort of shock here. Britain is not a member of the euro. Had it been a member of the euro, our currency would be 25% overvalued at the moment. That was a very, very important step. And it was a step back by Britain from ever closer union. Now, you could argue that that's enough. We're not a member of the Eurozone. The Eurozone will have to make its own arrangements. We didn't need to have this sort of mini crisis we just had over Europe. But I think Cameron rightly felt that he got a strong weight of opinion with his own party. A party is not a non-existent entity. It's a serious political entity. He got a real problem with his party. He's given himself 5 years, for goodness sake. It's about as long a period of time as makes sense in politics. I think he was trapped. He couldn't do much else. I think he got himself out of it deftly. It was a good speech, rhetorically, and he seems to have satisfied his immediate problem, which was within his own party and with the right wing in the country.
But the crucial question is how long that satisfaction lasts, I think, because you've got to... I mean, I was in the chamber yesterday at Prime Minister's questions, and there was a tremendous amount of cheering, you know, all sort of lusty cries of joy behind the Prime Minister on the Conservative benches. And you have to ask yourself, why are those people happy? They're happy for two reasons. They think they've won the argument, well, three reasons, in fact. They think they've won the argument on the European Union. And actually, a lot of people, that argument is about ultimately heading towards the exit. They think they've seized control of the Conservative agenda inside government, and they think they are thereby emancipated from coalition. Now, actually, none of those conditions is going to hold for very long. If David Cameron starts renegotiating or even begins a discussion with his European partners about repatriation of powers, there will have to be compromises in some other area, and those Conservative MPs are allergic to any kind of compromise. And the Liberal Democrats will now have to reassert their authority over government if they're not going to look like they've just been flattened and steamrolled by backbench Tory MPs. So I mean, the history of David Cameron's relationship with his party is he makes a big concession, he gets a cheer, and sometimes just within days, certainly little more than weeks or months, they're back on his back, giving him a hard time, making him look weak and forcing new concessions out of him.
I mean, Simon Andrew suggests that he's like quite deftly, accommodated in a necessary way that the demands of his party, but I got the sense from your answer before that you're kind of looking further down the track and seeing that this makes splits inevitable if indeed Cameron's elected and it goes ahead.
Well, he is very deft. He's like a really good bridge player who's playing rather weak cards, a weaker hand than he hoped for, just as he did immediately after the general election. He got that coalition signed and sealed in 5 days by making an offer to the Lib Dems that they couldn't turn down. So he is very, very good at that kind of politics. I admire him for it. And of course, in politics, you often have to do that kind of thing. I nevertheless think that, I mean, my position is hopelessly unfashionable, but I actually believe in parliamentary democracy. And that means that you elect MPs and then they decide, whether it's on the death penalty or on Europe or on the economy. They, in the end, decide. And these questions, particularly Europe, is continually changing. It's highly technical, it's intolerably boring in many ways, and it should be left to MPs. Now, that's not going to happen. We're going to have a referendum, but it's actually, there's a basic act of bad faith in this. It's not because the MPs want to be democratic, it's because Cameron wants to hold the Tory party together.
Why is holding the Tory party together a bad idea for a Tory leader?
It's not a bad idea, but the pretense is let's consult the people. Well, of course, the people in a referendum will very likely vote according to how they feel about all sorts of other things at the time of the referendum in any case. So I think it's a false prospectus, frankly, this idea that we're all going to be frightfully democratic about it. Most people who vote in the referendum will have even less idea than MPs do of whether Cameron has actually got any meaningful concessions at all.
But Simon, what about the idea that if Cameron's re-elected, big if, and the thing goes ahead, then, you know, he comes back and says, I've got a piece of paper in my hand which gives us a new deal on Europe. We don't know what it will say, but we sort of know that there's a large part of the Conservative Party, including possibly some people who might be around the cabinet table, who would say it's not enough, we're going to campaign for no. Do you think that
big deal. I mean, that's exactly what happened to Wilson.
I mean, the
position is Wilson in 75, absolutely mirror image.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, this is real politics. You can't sort of have your cake and eat it. I mean, Cameron found himself in a position where his party really was in trouble. That this speech had one prime duty, and that was to stave off UKIP. UKIP was in a position where it was really going to deny him power. I mean, it was a serious threat. We had to wait and see. I may be completely wrong, but my impression is he's really cut UKIP off at the knees. That is a bluntly a masterstroke of politics. I mean, he's a bridge player, but bridge players with bad cards sometimes win.
Raf, I mean, okay. First of all, do you buy that? Do you think UKIP is bitten off and seen off at the pass? And if it is, what do you think it does to the fight, the bigger fight with Labour?
Well, I think it's hard to call that, obviously, because UKIP's support is based not just on hostility to the European Union. In fact, it's based substantially on, if you look at what UKIP voters tell pollsters, they're more cross about welfare and immigration and crime and other sort of classically hard right ultra-conservative issues than the European Union. The danger for Cameron was the Tories being beaten by UKIP in the overall popular share of the vote in the European election next year. And from that point of view, I'm sure there will be some sort of soft UKIP considerers who will drift back to the Tories. And in that case, what you then have is a situation where the margin of error, or sort of the Labour lead falls back into the margin of error, because actually, you know, if the Labour lead is a lot of Lib Dem refugees going back to Labour and some Tories going off to UKIP. So it's not that much in it between Tories and Labour at sort of core vote level. And then you'll have a terrible attack of the nerves in the Labour Party and a lot of people who from time to time question Ed Miliband's strategy, his judgment, his capability of looking like a strong, commanding leader. That'll all come out. And then really the political dynamic could change very, very dramatically.
So yesterday, as we've heard in the House, Ed Miliband was emphatic, you know, we do not want this referendum. A little bit of kind of equivocation from
Labour people
are saying. The vote now.
Yes, what Labour people are saying is that the sort of Ed Miliband sort of misspoke in Parliament yesterday, that what he meant to say is right now we don't think this is the right thing to be doing, but he somehow sort of accidentally said we definitely don't ever want the referendum on an in-out referendum. That isn't, those aren't his exact words, but that's how it came across. Opinion is divided on this. Obviously, some people think, look, if you're going to oppose a referendum, you know, do it with guts. Don't
get it done now.
Get it done. Well, be solid. Say, look, no, this is a waste of time. We've got better things to be talking about. But there are a lot of people in the shadow cabinet, a lot of people in the Labour Party who recognise that, or who think that you can't go into an election against the people. You want to be going to an election against the other parties. And if the other party has sewn up the argument that they trust the, you know, the population to, you know, take the, make this choice, then it's going to be really hard not to match that pledge at some stage. So, you know, although in politics it's sort of more dramatic to either slam a door shut or fling it open, Ed Miliband's chosen to keep it slightly ajar. Mm. It doesn't look great, but he wants that room for manoeuvre. That's his style of politics.
Simon, do you think the calculation, it seems to me, is definitely different for Labour, isn't it? Because for a start, they're ahead in the polls. They'd have the same pressure from within the party. But for another thing, it would be a much harder referendum for Ed Miliband to win, perhaps, because he'd be very likely to have the opposition against him if he was campaigning for a yes.
Well, this is not the referendum. This is the vote to have one. And he was quite specific in his indecision. I mean, he was just briefly. I mean, these things all pass. I mean, just briefly, Cameron nonplussed both UKIP and Labour. I mean, the Dems, everyone's been in favour of a referendum at some stage or another. I agree with Andrew. I mean, this is all certainly synthetic politics. But I mean, all politics is a bit synthetic. I think that most members of the public, whenever asked questions, like referendums. They like being allowed to vote. You know, they like votes. They'd vote for rat catchers if they got the chance. I don't think that's the issue. I think that one will sort of go away. I personally have to say, I think this will go away as an issue. The one thing that Cameron's done, which is substantive, is I think he has substantially diminished the UKIP threat to the right wing of the Conservative Party. There will always be a right wing. I think, you know, you're quite right that UKIP represents far more than Europe. I mean, the whole range of countryside and planning issues has now been swept up by them, and wind turbines. I mean, that's sort of soft politics. Europe was quite hard politics, and I do think Cameron has given himself some breathing space, and that's what politicians are supposed to do.
One important point that has to be remembered here about the Labour position is that the strongest reason for not wanting to have a referendum is one they can't say in public, which is that Ed Miliband essentially thinks he's got a strong chance of becoming Prime Minister, and he doesn't want to start his first term fighting a campaign to stay in the European Union. That is essentially David Cameron's problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So sympathy then for the different calculations. But Andrew, let's just close on your nobly unfashionable view about referendums. You say that you want politicians to make all the tough decisions on everything and not to hand it back to the people. Just think about the other referendums we've had recently and the one we've got coming up, Scotland and the AV vote, for example. What do you take away from those?
Well, AV, I don't think people did want to have a say about it, did they? I mean, people really weren't interested in AV. And another incredibly technical question, which repays study, but you can't expect sort of 50, however many voters there are to all to study it. Scotland, I think, yes, I think there it is. If there's a genuine prospect of independence, then that does actually, even I would concede that a popular vote is needed.
OK, well, let's leave that there for now. But don't worry, you can find out plenty more on this debate, probably for the next 5 years, at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, heavy fighting in the north of Africa involving groups linked to Al-Qaeda has once again concentrated minds in Whitehall on Britain's defence forces. It comes amid announcements on further reductions in the army and possible compulsory redundancies this year. Now, Simon, defence is traditionally an area that the right is more nervous about cutting than other areas of spending. And yet, with troops deployed in Afghanistan, recent incursions in Libya and a tiny bit of dabbling around the edge now with the French operation in Mali, it doesn't seem like the military ambition is going down with the military spending.
Well, it's all madness. I mean, it's no good asking me on this. I mean, I just think this is completely crazy. I mean, we shouldn't be in these countries, that we haven't got an interest there. We're not serving any purpose there. And we keep getting beaten. I mean, I can't see any point in it at all. If there is a threat from Al-Qaeda, which is pretty minimal, but such threat as they pose to Britain and to the West, for that matter, is essentially a policing matter. And we should be concentrating on our police, our special forces, our spies, whatever. But the idea that, the Brigade of Guards is going to do something about Al-Qaeda is so, so absurd, so sort of boy's own paper. It's amazing it still has any currency whatsoever, but you're quite right, it does, because sort of there's a sort of a tribal totem pole erected to the British Armed Forces, which supposes that an aircraft carrier is going to somehow stop an Al-Qaeda bomber.
And whatever the sort of wider problems with it, the kind of liberal intervention that we're seeing, at some point, isn't it going to run into a brick wall if we're laying off troops left, right and centre at the same time as wanting to do these things?
Well, the more you lay off troops, the less likely you are to make a really stupid decision. These armies are a standing invitation to politicians to use them somewhere abroad where they have nothing to do with us. I mean, I just simply can't see the argument. It's the ultimate in sort of symbolic nationalism, and it's completely pointless and dangerous.
Andrew, we had the timely intervention of Prince Harry this week talking about taking out members of the Taliban. I wonder, what does a prince on parade like that do to questions about laying off other soldiers?
I would have thought that it goes down very well, doesn't it? And it gives a poor, superfluous young man something worthwhile, a purpose in life to go off and do exciting things in Afghanistan, I think. When he's not doing sort of vaguely amusing things in Las Vegas. I mean, I think it's a sort of winning combination, actually. It's exactly how a lot of people would like to spend their time.
Killing.
a mixture of adventure. It's not the brigade. Well, he was in the Household Cavalry, wasn't he? But it's not really Brigade of Guards. It's more sort of SAS-style stuff, right. Which people under Simon suggests. It may be an illusion, but we're under the illusion that these gallant characters can occasionally sort of go and rescue someone or...
Yeah, I might not express it the same way, but I'm inclined to agree broadly to the extent that, I mean, people's reaction to the whole Prince Harry, the publicity around his role, will be conditioned by their attitude to monarchy in general. So there is a small minority of people who hate the idea of monarchy, and they'll think it's ridiculous that he's doing this. And I think most people will think, well, he's an emblem, he's part of this sort of sovereign Britain PLC. It's a bit of a PR job, it's a bit of a recruiting tool. There was nothing really to see there apart from a bit of an advert for the royal family and the armed forces.
But what, what if 6 months down the line we're giving out P-45s to lots of young squaddies at the same time as glorifying this prince who's doing the same job? Does that make that a harder political sell?
I think people, I think if it was a politician, it would be different, or the son of a politician getting some preferential treatment. I think that generally in Britain, we hold these two things in completely separate parts of our brains. We sort of see the PR function of the royal family as separate. And I mean, as I say, I think it's you get political traction when you think that George Osborne is a millionaire or that David Cameron is a millionaire. I think the royal family just sit in a different sort of cultural political space, to be honest.
Okay, well, let's leave them there. But then if there are more cuts to come, which I'm sure there will be, both because there's such big ones in train already. And then we've had this week talk about the coalition, Danny Alexander and George Osborne having to make agree further cuts ahead of the next election about what happens in the year after. How is Trident looking in that picture, do you think, Simon?
Well, I mean, it almost proves the point. I mean, if you've got a slight problem on your public expenditure totals, and you say, as Alexander said, I mean, quite rightly, what on earth do we need Trident sailing around 24 hours a day out in the Atlantic for? It shows, frankly, the pointlessness of this weapon. There's no conceivable situation in which we'd ever use it. There's no conceivable person we know who's being deterred by it. It's absolutely no purpose at all, except to spend very large sums of money. And if it takes a credit crunch or a public expenditure crisis to bring this home to people, fine. But it is just bizarre that you can be talking quite drastically about cuts in social benefits, in welfare services, in a whole range of local activities as being absolutely necessary, and leave this stupid boat wandering about in the Atlantic at millions of pounds expense. It just shows what a wonderful fantasy country we still live in.
Although I suppose from your point of view, Simon, is it better than spending the money on troops because at least Trident won't get used?
Well, you could put it that way. I mean, that really is a crazy approach to public expenditure. But I mean, the idea of an army, a navy, and an air force, waiting for the French and the Germans to cross the Channel, is about as out of date as you could possibly conceive. If you just look at the wars we're actually fighting, most of our European partners wouldn't take part in this conversation. The French would, but apart from them, they're aware that we're now in the 21st century, and such threats as exist are very complex, very sort of localized, detailed threats that come from very unpleasant people who are not susceptible to traditional deterrence or traditional armies.
Andrew, do you think, this is the year where the cutting gets deeper and it starts to be felt in earnest all around the country in all sorts of ways? Do you think that things that have been unthinkable in British political discourse, like getting rid of Trident, are going to become mainstream?
Yes, I think when your income falls, and Simon spoke in an ironic tone of a slight problem with public spending. We actually have an enormous problem with public spending. Adding to the debt by $100 billion a year is plainly utterly unsustainable. So you suddenly realise, it's like realising that actually if you have people round to supper, you don't actually have to give them champagne. You can radically reduce costs and still have we can radically reduce costs and still have the armed forces that we need. I think it is utterly ludicrous actually to have things like Trident. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. So my thanks to Raphael Baer, to Simon Jenkins, and to Andrew Jimson. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, Algeria hostage crisis over after further casualties, spies, Chopin, and a last-minute rescue in Libya. And our audiobook review is a crime special looking at Raymond Chandler's greatest stories and a new audiobook from Stuart Neville, Ratlines. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.